Welcome to the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota. This is Arts and Cultural Heritage producer Jeff Carmack, and today we're going to be revisiting St. Cloud State University's School of the Arts Creative Arts Series with a conversation with Tim Miller. Miller has performed throughout North America, Australia, and Europe, and is known for both his humor and his passion, as well as for his longevity in the field. He began his work in the 1980s. In 1990, he was awarded a National Endowment for the Arts grant, which was stripped from him, as well as from three others, by the first Bush administration, which resulted in a lawsuit that went all the way to the Supreme Court. Since 1999, Miller has focused primarily on marriage equality and injustices faced by the gay and lesbian communities in America. And now, as this political environment has changed, he's got some new things to talk about. Tim Miller will be on campus for the Creative Arts Series residency for this week with a performance on Wednesday, September 30th at 8 p.m. at the Performing Arts Center Center Stage. And there'll be another performance with his workshop students on Friday, October 2nd at 8 p.m. in Headley Hall. So, welcome, Tim.
Hey, Jeffrey.
Hi, Tim. How's it going?
I'm good. How are you doing today?
Excellent, excellent, excellent. How about we start off and you can just tell us a little bit about what exactly has brought you to St. Cloud State?
You know, I mean, I'm performing on Wednesday, but, you know, my stuff. But what I'm, of course, really doing is working with 25, you know, Minnesota performers around their, you know, they're, you know, and I'm sure the vast majority of the students are from Minnesota, I would think, probably a couple international students. You know, it'll be bringing their kind of, you know, life stories, experience. So, it is really the stories of Central Minnesota coming forward out of this week workshop. Well, it was really through the communication studies, performance studies folks that I'm close to and work with, you know, kind of the national community around performance studies through communication studies, which, and St. Cloud has a really great department in communication around performance studies. So we'd been talking for quite a while, and they were really interested in having me come and do one of my residencies. And the professors there, Tammy Spry and Jen Tudor, we've been concocting this for a while. And then they connected with the other energies at St. Cloud, and it's all come together that way. But I travel a lot, and about 20 weeks a year, and I do frequently do these intensive workshops where I come in and, you know, I always perform, you know, some of my work, solo work, but the main thing I really do is come in and work with, you know, usually 20 or so students around creating their own original performance pieces around their life stories, their families, the things that are urgent to them, that matter to them from, you know, their upbringing or their, what's happening right now and their lives in St. Cloud, and it's incredibly fun and interesting, and so that's what we'll start tonight when I have my first meeting with the large group. It'll be a blast.
Nice, yeah. That storytelling, allowing the students to identify, you know, who are they, you know, what are the things that they have going on, and those are our stories. That's where our history comes from.
Yeah, no, absolutely, and kind of beginning to tell that story starts to change it in some ways, because you start to have a more active relationship to, you know, what your life narrative is, what matters, what where you want to go in the future, especially, because I think telling, you know, speaking about what's happened in the past, what's happening right now, is a way of starting to chart your course for where you want your life to go, which is important for any of us at any point in our lives, but certainly when you're working with undergrads or grad students, as I do so much. I think it's extremely purposeful and interesting to kind of, you're also writing, telling the future, which I really think is important.
Yeah, the idea of you being able to look back and see, you know, where did you come from and where are you going, that kind of thing. So, along those lines, I was looking at, you know, your website, you know, timmillerperformer.com, and if I count it up right, you've got like kind of 14 major pieces over, is that kind of correct? Or
Yeah, it's probably a little more, but okay. I'm not really sure. I was like, I couldn't sleep one night, and I did try to count on my fingers at like 3 a.m., it sort of depends which ones I count, but there's a lot. I've been making work. I moved to New York City from California when I was 19 and started making making my own pieces and was one of the people really associated with the, you know, the development of this solo performance, you know, form over the last, you know, 30 plus years in my life in New York and then later in Los Angeles. And for me, certainly, my pieces were, you know, have been hugely around my identity as a gay man and the way my life, love, political struggles have mirrored and been sometimes center stage in a lot of what's going on in our national discourse, whether it was, you know, all the pieces I made responding to HIV/AIDS as a young artist in my, you know, end of my teens, early 20s, you know, and all through my 20s and responding to, you know, many years of work I've been doing around marriage equality and in the last 15 years or so and my own kind of, you know, Supreme Court case around being one of the gay artists attacked by the you know, the Republican White House and Congress in the early 90s and taken them to the Supreme Court, you know, how I spent the 90s. And in some ways, even right now, just the story and that feeling of how these stories change. I've performed, you know, dozens and dozens of times in Minnesota. And but this time I landed, you know, at MSP on Saturday night. It was the first time the plane was touching down with Minnesota, because I haven't been here since Marriage Equality arrived in Minnesota. So I was very aware, okay, this is the first time I'm landing into a quality state and a state that played such a leadership role in the whole, you know, this whole social justice venture we've been in as, you know, one of the very first states to vote, you know, for equality. So I was very, very happy to arrive in Minnesota that has a, you know, very honorable role in all of this. So, and that what I'm performing on Wednesday night, which will be some of my, you know, it's a little bit of my greatest hits kind of thing, of some of my very favorite pieces, and but also the kind of chart performance that engages, you know, the world and the social, you know, texts that have been important to me. And a really new piece, which is sort of this moment we're in right now after the two Supreme Court decisions and marriage equality. And my husband, Alistair, and I were married on the day the mm-hmm. Defense of Marriage Act was overturned a little over 2 years ago. And he's Australian, and it meant we could finally get him a green card so that we can, you know, now begin to plan that we can actually remain in this country. So the final piece I'll do on Wednesday is sort of that happy event and also where we go from here.
Yeah, that is kind of, there are a few things you touched on there that I was definitely wanting to touch upon, but one of the videos you have on your website, the full performance of Lay of the Land, comes back around to, you know, hey, someday, you know, we'll be able to be married and, you know, like actually married, like other people are married.
Right.
And, you know, it's one of those things, it's no longer gay marriage, now it's just marriage.
Right. Yeah, it'll be interesting as that language will disappear. Well, it was already on the way out because people knew it was sort of, you know, inaccurate. Actually, it's just marriage, but it'll disappear totally, which is kind of great, I think, as we catch up as how we talk about things catches up with the reality.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, I had another one of my friends, he was very instrumental in working on the change in Minnesota. And one of the things that they found that was very effective, and then this is now, you know, kind of, you know, how people do it now, is when you're having a discussion with somebody and they're, you know, obviously on the other side, it's usually because they haven't really thought about it.
Or don't know anybody.
Yeah, or don't know anybody. But they found that making it personal, talking about, you know, this person and this person will be able to, you know, actually have the, you know, benefits and everything that everybody else does. And then eventually everybody actually does know somebody, whether it's somebody's, you know, a niece or a nephew or even a grandchild or, you know, a neighbor's kid or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Like that. And then, you know, they can look at that and be, you know, personal, that personal family thing where it's just like, well, you know, hey, that's, you know, that does make sense. And, you know, that comes back to the storytelling.
Right. And kind of the kinship and people knowing each other and looking at each other and certainly hearing their stories really matters. But, you know, I think, you know, clearly I think homophobia will be, you know, really totally dismantled when everybody finally realizes they have gay friends, family members, professors, you know, all that, just as I think the only thing that'll probably really, really unpack and undo the this ticking bomb of racism in America is, you know, when just the many, many millions of you know, biracial people finally, that every white person has got a person of color in their family. Like all the future, well, the majority of the future Millers in my family, of my nieces and nephews are all biracial. So it's, in some ways that means that Millers from now on can't really, you know, in my family, we're not just white anymore. You know, we're kind of a new kind of family, and that I think really changes things too. And there's, you know, every year there's going to be a larger and larger percentage of people that are multiracial. Well, and of course our president is, you know, we think of him as a African American, but he is a multiracial president.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's just such a huge, amazing, great thing our country did to be the first, you know, Eurocentric country to elect a person of color head of state. It's like, it's a giant, you know, 1,000 years from now, it's probably the only thing anybody will give a shit about. So. And then what had been a white country elected a person of a different race as the head of state for the first time.
Absolutely.
The first country to do that. So it's... Anyway, a bit off subject, but interesting to both of us. So.
But yet at the same time, it's still it still is really the same topic, you know, whether, I mean, everybody's got their thing, you know, everybody's, either it's their sexuality or their gender or their race, everybody's different, but yet we're all the same, you know, we're all human, we can donate blood to one another and all that. And,
unless you're gay.
Yeah. Well, I hear that's changing too, because that actually touches on a different topic, yeah. Because of AIDS, for the longest time, and I think this is still going on, but I heard that maybe it was changing.
They're changing. You know, if you know, the rules are still totally different. You're a gay person in this country can only donate blood if they haven't had sex in like 5 years.
Yeah.
You know, which of course they'll let any, you know, straight person who's had, you know, 300 partners in the last 6 months donate blood. But it's ridiculous. We're almost the only country that does this. There's blood screening for, you know, they screen the blood anyway. So it's sort of a weird way of, yeah. And actually, it's funny you should mention this, because this is a topic I find a lot of younger undergraduate gay men, they just find it unbelievable, because that their blood is seen as dirty. And that, you know, because they do blood drives on campuses a lot, and it's suddenly, there's been a lot of protest and organizing around this, and getting people to go in, and everyone who goes in says that, oh, well, but I've had same-sex sex recently, so I can't give blood, you know, to just make the blood drives realize how unfair it is. But it's funny, it's actually something I've internalized. It's just stupid and pointless, you know. This many decades after, you know, the arrival of HIV/AIDS, you know, but it's something that really pisses off young people. And I'm always love when I get, wow, so this is something that's on their radar screen that matters to them, that seems worth fighting about. So, and it's something I've really noticed in the last year or two that on campuses that young queer kids are really worked up about this.
You're in tune to 88.1 FM KVSC and the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota. Today we're talking with Tim Miller, who's in town this week for the St. Cloud State University's Creative Arts Series. On Wednesday, September 30th, he'll be performing at 8 o'clock at the Performing Arts Center, St. Cloud State University campus, and then his workshop students will be performing on Friday, October 2nd at Headley Hall, also at 8 o'clock. And now as we get back into our discussion, we're going to talk about his experience in the early 90s with the National Endowments for the Arts and a controversy over a grant that wound up going all the way to the Supreme Court.
You know, I always, you know, it's certainly a big part of my, you know, my CV, because it was a giant event, and it was, you know, we were the most visible part of the worst period of that culture war in around 1990. Myself and three other artists, performance artists, you know, which is also appropriate since performance studies is really been, you know, leading, bringing me in, and to St. Cloud State, but it's they took away our unanimously recommended National Endowment for the Arts Solo Performance Fellowship, Solo Theater Fellowships, actually, under pressure from President Bush the Daddy, White House, purely because of the content of our work, you know, because three of the four of us were lesbian or gay, and myself, John Fleck, and Holly Hughes, and Karen Finley was, you know, a fierce feminist performer, queer in every other way. You know, and created a huge firestorm of protests that, oh my gosh, here in America, as cultural freedom is breaking out in Eastern Europe at that time, that we were losing it here at home. You know, it was very stark, you know, as the, you know, Iron Curtain was falling, and then meanwhile, the Republicans in Congress and the White House were trying to silence artists in our own country, you know, at that time, you know, in a really dramatic way. So it threw me into, you know, a 10-year period of really high visibility and all over, you know, after the NEA for defundings, it was just all over the media, and we took the White House and the National Endowment for the Arts to the Supreme Court over the next many years. We won our grants back at the federal court appellate level, and then what went to the Supreme Court over the next many years was this notion that it is constitutional for the government to censor artists around this bizarre notion of general standards of decency, which actually was upheld, that our country can censor its artists and not, you know, in terms of funding, if it's the work is perceived to be indecent, which is, you know, strangely unlegalistic kind of language. Like, what does that mean? You know, mm-hmm. So it's, and that we lost, you know, that part. We had gotten our grants back and all our court costs to the ACLU, but it was an incredible journey and a huge marking, you know, marker for me at that time, as my work was really, you know, really around performance of, you know, the resurgent homophobia in our country, you know, especially because of HIV/AIDS, and I was doing a lot of work around AIDS and AIDS activism, and also having to fight on the First Amendment front. So it was a really charged period, and, you know, much looked at and studied in contemporary, you know, culture and theater history classes, and hardly a day goes by I don't have to talk about it, because we were the only case that went all the way to the Supreme Court in that period. So it was the culture war, you know, case. So it's become, you know, historically quite important.
Yeah, there's that idea of, you know, hey, this is the land of the free, but it's, you know, you can be free to be exactly how I tell you to be.
Right, exactly. And without any cent of your own, you know, without a single cent of your own tax money coming back to you through, you know, federal funding of the arts. So,
absolutely, absolutely. Well, coming back to the arts and performance, you know, you have been all over the country, and, you know, performances here, there, and everywhere. And the humor you've got in your performances is kind of astounding, especially how it all, you know, it's circling back around. You've got these things that are happening, these situations, and, you know, they're pretty intense, you know, like the, you know, with the homophobia and everything like this, but yet you're approaching it with humor, and especially, you know, you're walking into these communities. I kind of use community as a very broad thing. It's not necessarily just a city, but, you know, like,
sure.
Like for example, when you went to Alaska, that, you know, that was kind of cute.
Yeah, I love Alaska.
Yeah, yeah. The way that you're approaching this, and you were talking about Matthew Shepard as well. At one point, I happened to be living in Colorado when that happened, and that was kind of a shocking thing to imagine that, you know, people would do that. But yet at the same time, I guess it wasn't that shocking.
Were you in Denver?
I was in Boulder.
Oh, all right.
So yeah.
The Boulder bubble, but, you know, the Matthew Shepard story is a Colorado story. He'd been in Fort Collins that night, and, you know, people, you know, if you want to go to a gay bar, you go to Fort Collins from Laramie. So it's, you know, it's a couple hours, I think, but it's, yeah, I bet being in a Rocky Mountain state at that moment, because it suddenly recast how we understand, you know, the Rocky Mountain states, and it would have, your proximity to it would have been strong, I think.
Yeah, yeah, it was. There was definitely, you know, the students around. I went to the Naropa University in Boulder.
Wow.
So, yeah, the students there, everybody was just, well, like, what is going on? You know, and it just, it was not ignored. It was not blown off. It was, I mean, everybody was addressing it with everybody, you know, and talking about it and, you know, trying to figure out how to, you know, organize. Well, you know, and that's where it gets tricky, I think, is that idea of, you know, well, something happened. We're going to organize against it or organize for something. And it's like, well, what do you do? You know, you're just going to, you know, walk down the street with signs, or what do you do? And I think that ties back to performance is, you know, how do you express something that, you know, maybe a lot of the other people who are around, you know, within the community, they don't want to hear it, or maybe it's not that big of a deal to them, or maybe they're, you know, the perpetrators of this. You know,
well, and if you, it's a good example with you know, the horribly sad story of Matthew Shepard's, you know, murder. Mm-hmm. Because actually, the strongest response was a cultural response, and the you know, play The Laramie Project by the Tectonic Theater Company has been the most performed play in this country in colleges and universities almost every year ever since, you know, since it was first produced, you know, 15 years ago. You know, it's a play that has really had a long reach of, you know, what did these artists were asking that question, and it's very much a kind of community-based performance question, is, okay, this horrible thing has happened. We're in New York. What do we do? Well, we're a company that generates plays out of interviewing people, and they went to Laramie and just did all those incredible, you know, interviews with the people, you know, on all kind of sides and spectrums of, you know, point of view and belief and stuff, and crafted it into, I think, one of the most important, you know, theater pieces ever, which, you know, would later be a HBO film and stuff. So that's, in some ways, that's that creative response, you know, because otherwise the response ultimately was legal and, you know, the court cases, and these people who killed him are in prison forever probably. But it's the lingering way we understand this is through creative practice and through all these, again, like you were talking about with, you know, the production you were in recently, a lot of young actors being in Laramie Project is their first experience of you know, thinking about gay people, if they don't know anybody, of having to potentially perform a gay person in the play, of really having the production of the play lead them into their own journey about what their community is like. And of course, often the play, The Laramie Project, is, you know, censored whenever high schools in conservative parts of the country try to do it because they think it's, you know, promoting gay identity, which, you know, it is, only in that it's promoting respect for everybody. And so it's a good template, because it is that it's a devised performance, much like what I'm going to make this week with the St. Cloud students, you know, a different kind of process and took a lot longer. But it is basically the same impulse, as we need to make stuff that responds to what's going on right now. And yesterday, and you know, I did an eight-hour workshop at the University of Minnesota, and you know, the pieces the students making are so about what's happening on campus right now around, you know, sexual assault and, you know, racial incidents and you know, body shame and, you know, they're, you know, oppressive parents and all that. You get plenty of that. But the pieces had such a rich social vision, and one woman literally the night before had seen someone standing on a bridge, you know, much used for people to jump off of in St. Paul, and did an absolutely stunning performance about, you know, driving, seeing someone standing up there wanting to drive on but not able to, and going up and talking to the person, you know, finding, because someone she knew had jumped off that bridge. And I told her afterwards, you have got to keep making this piece. This is so, well, also September is Suicide Prevention Month, as mm-hmm. Facebook tells us. you know, what a beautiful, useful piece, not just that you need to tell, but the world needs, that we need to tell these stories and to create these visibilities. And it was just so moving, and just, you know, just kind of coming out of a workshop, and she maybe only worked on the piece for 10 or 15 minutes, and it was so beautiful. And that's sort of what I look for, is to see pieces that the students need, or the community members, if I'm not at a university, need to make, but also that the world needs, that these are stories we need to hear, and human life moments that bear bear our witness.
Absolutely, yeah. That's one of these things. I've had a few friends that have, well, passed on that were dealing with very complicated issues, and yeah, it's tough. You know, it's something that, you know, unless you've gone through something very similar, you might not have a frame of reference for, but you can at least tell that, you know, somebody's struggling. And I think that's something which is, you know, looking back through history, you know, we can see these different struggles that different communities have had, but yet, you know, what are our struggles today? There still are struggles. They're going to be different, but, you know, they're still there. And, you know, something that I always say at the end of my radio shows, I also do music DJing here too, because that's how I got involved with the place originally, is, you know, the revolution is the celebration. And it's celebrating, well, who are you? You know, and by doing that, by celebrating, you end up changing everything. But it can be tough, you know, if somebody is discovering they're transgendered, you know, that's going to open up this huge can of worms, and it's going to be confusing, and it's going to be unique. Or, you know, if somebody's, you know, maybe, you know, discovering that they're gay, there's going to be changes. But yet at the same time, that's who you are, and you got to celebrate that, because, you know, you're alive.
Right, exactly. And maybe that performance, both for the performer, is their first step in grounding themselves, claiming their truth, claiming their journey and stuff. But also for the people that see the piece, it becomes kind of a fundamental way of learning and growth and change. I feel like I have had some of my best lessons, growthful experiences around, you know, especially around, you know, racism, sexism, homophobia, has happened in watching performance, you know, movies and television too, of course, but there's something about live performance, because the bodies are actually there. You might meet the performer after. There may be a Q&A afterwards where people keep talking about it. You're aware of something really happening in that moment. And of course, I'm a performer. I would value and privilege, you know, live performing in a particular way. But I think there is something quite, you know, quite unique and special about it.
Awesome. Let's see here. Maybe something kind of going back to just, you know, how you frame things within your performances. One of the more humorous ones that I ran across, like I said, a lot of this, I mean, we're talking about some deep stuff here, but you do approach things with humor in a great
right.
way. I like the homo mileage points. yeah, this is... I almost want to phrase this in a different way, but, you know, well, how do these things come to you? How do you kind of develop these quirky little examples of, well, how we deal with life?
Well, you know, some of it is just following your own delight or your own kinks of you know, including I was in that show you watched that's on the whole show's on YouTube. You know, has that quite funny, you know, university mascot kind of imagining, you know, a sexual relationship with Goldie Gopher, you know, which I of course know that's the Minnesota, you know, mascot. I really like university animal mascots. I think they're really funny. And
yeah, there's something about that. Yeah.
There's something so kinky about, you know, and it's so American. It's like they do it a tiny bit in Canada, but otherwise it's something really the U.S. does and nobody else does. And I'm totally into it. I think kind of giving yourself just permission to imagine, you know, the absurdity, the humor, and I do use humor, you know, an enormous amount, partly because I'm also touching on pretty strong, you know, political texts and, you know, sexuality and stuff that might make people, you know, either get nervous or their hackles up. And humor is, you know, I think, you know, just one of the most effective ways to keep people in the room. And so, you know, I'm also very into frequent flyer miles. And I thought there should be a program where people, you know, but whether people are gay or an ally, that people should, whenever they do things that fight homophobia, they should get these homo mileage points that they could then cash in for, you know, valuable prizes. I don't think it's actually catching on, but I wish it would.
Well, you never know. I mean, there's the social media out there today that could be something that develops. You know?
Right, so, exactly.
Tim, thanks for chatting with us today, and we look forward to...
My pleasure, yeah.
Probably see you on Wednesday, I would imagine.
Come along. It'll be fun.
Right on. Well, hey, have a great day, and we'll talk with you soon.
Okay, thanks a lot.
And we've been speaking with Tim Miller today on the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota. Miller will be on campus Wednesday, September 30th for a performance.
at the Center Stage at the Performing Arts Center at 8 p.m. And then his workshops class students will be performing on Friday, October 2nd at 8 p.m. in Headley Hall. For more information on Tim Miller and St. Cloud State University's Creative Arts Series, you can find links on our website at kvsc.org under the Podcasts and Untold Stories of Central Minnesota tab. The Untold Stories of Central Minnesota is made possible through funding by a grant from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and has been produced at KVSC, a proud member of AMPERS, Diverse Radio for Minnesota's Communities.